If you enjoy the Liturgist podcast but would like to go deeper, if you'd like to learn more and talk to others going through a journey in appreciating the world equally through science, through art, and through faith, we'd like to invite you to subscribe to this program on Patreon. Patreon is a site designed for people to raise monthly support through donations, but we've actually kind of moved away from the donation model and instead created additional content available for a very affordable subscription of $5 a month. So, of course, we'll take any amount of money as a donation. If you want to give $1 or $2 or $3 a month, that's fine. And if you do that, you'll get access to a second podcast called The Liturgist Conversations, which is a behind-the-scenes look at how the Liturgist podcast is produced. But for people who subscribe at $5 a month, we create weekly meditations to help you deepen your spiritual practice. And sometimes we do a series of daily meditations, so that's available to you. And of course, some people also subscribe at the $20 a month tier, which probably for right now gets back in that donation mindset. But we do have some additional time to talk and discuss things about the program with people at the $20 level, and occasionally some in-person meetups as well. So if you're interested in learning more about subscribing to the additional resources we make available to our patrons, simply go to theliturgist.com and click on the Join Us button in the upper right-hand corner to find out more.
Michael King was born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1929. Then in 1935, Michael's father changed both his own and his son's name to Martin Luther King to honor the Protestant reformer Martin Luther. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. became one of the most famous and beloved advocates for justice and civil rights in history, who is known for his eloquent and beautiful speeches, in which he would say things like, quote, "Peace is not merely a distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal," unquote. How ironic, then, that Dr. Martin Luther King practiced his faith in the stream of and was named after the German anti-Semitic reformer who advocated for the massacre of peasants. Here are a couple Martin Luther quotes. In speaking of the peasants, he said, quote, "Let everyone who can smite, slay, and stab, secretly or openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel. It is just as when one must kill a mad dog. If you do not strike him, he will strike you and a whole land with you," unquote. He also advocated violence like this towards who he called the blind Jews, who were, and I quote, "truly stupid fools," unquote. He had a 7-solution problem for the Jews. First, to set fire to their synagogues or schools and to bury and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever again see a stone or cinder of them. Second, he said, I advise that their houses also be razed and destroyed. The other 5 steps included depriving Jews of their employment and making them do hard labor instead, taking all of their money, and killing any teaching rabbis or Jews who leave their home. Does any of that sound familiar to anybody else? So, here's my question. Is Christianity primarily a religion of peace, love, and shalom, or of violence, bigotry, and oppression? Who's more representative of Christianity, Martin Luther or Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? What's more representative of Christianity, Matthew 5, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, or 1 Samuel 15, do not spare them but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey? Is it those who live by the sword die by the sword, or slaves obey your masters? I mean, how can one religion give rise to Pope Francis, who speaks to outsiders to the Catholic Church like this? Quote, Since many of you do not belong to the Catholic Church and others are non-believers, from the bottom of my heart, I give this silent blessing to each and every one of you, respecting the conscience of each one of you, but knowing that each one of you is a child of God, unquote. But also give rise to popes like Gregory IX, who created the Papal Inquisition, in which thousands of people were tortured and murdered with methods including starvation, burning victims' bodies with hot coals, forced overconsumption of water, hanging by straps, thumbscrews, metal pincers, and of course the rack, for being unbelieving heretics. How can one religion produce both Christian pacifism and Christian terrorism, Christian abolitionists, and Christian support and justification of slavery, children's hospitals, and the Crusades? How is St. Francis of Assisi, who gave everything to the poor and who spent a lot of his time communing with animals in the forest, a part of the same faith as the climate-exploiting capitalistic evangelical war machine? How can members of the Ku Klux Klan subscribe to the same ancient creeds as the African Methodist Episcopal Church? How can a group dedicated to following a man who was executed by the state be some of the biggest proponents of executions by the state? I ask it again. Is Christianity a religion of peace, or is it a religion of violence? Welcome to the Liturgist Podcast.
Just recently, I was in Texas. The South is like the death belt. It's sort of the buckle of that. You know, Texas is half of all executions are in this one state. So I was traveling around creating a conversation around this. And one of the folks who shared their story, it was pretty incredible. She is a Texas pastor, Deanna Golson. So she's a pastor that told me her story. And someone visited her church and they said, "Hey, Pastor, I got a question for you." Deanna says, "I was ready for anything. You know, do I believe in hell, substitutionary atonement, you know, Trinity, whatever, but bring it, you know?" And the woman says, "Are you for the death penalty?" And she says, I was shocked. You know, she said, "Yeah, I am for the death penalty." And the woman just collapsed. And she said, "My son is set to be executed in the near future, and I just needed a pastor to walk with me."
This is author, speaker, and social justice advocate Shane Claiborne.
And Deanna, basically, Reverend Golson, she just said, "Okay, I'm going to put all that on the back burner, and I want to walk with you through this. I want to be your pastor in this." And she began to accompany this mother as her son faced execution. And she said, as I began to see what we're doing, and in particular, it was actually during the season of Lent, you know, as Jesus's execution is on the horizon, she said, I began to feel this collision, you know, with my faith. And she said, and then it became real when he didn't want his mother to witness his execution. And she said, they asked me. So she became the witness in the execution chamber, and she said, I had gotten to know this young man, I'd gotten to know his mom, and now I'm watching the state I live in, the system that I have justified and supported, take his life. And she said, so here he is, he gets strapped to the gurney, and his last words are, I want to ask for forgiveness from everybody that I've hurt. And then he says, and I want to extend forgiveness to those who are getting ready to hurt me and to take my life. His last words were forgiveness. So he's executed. And then Reverend Golson says, my last job was to walk his mother to the coffin so she could touch his hand for the first time in 10 years. They weren't allowed contact visits. And so the first time that she could touch the flesh of her son was when he was dead. And she said, I realized what we are doing. And so many people just haven't seen the real dark side of this. When Scripture says we're wrestling against not flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, I think that's exactly what is at stake in the death penalty. And I think it raises so many other huge questions. And so in the end, like Reverend Golson now has been on panels with me as one, a pastor who was formerly an advocate and supporter of the death penalty, that now is passionately against it. And it's because of her faith and also because of her love for justice and her love for victims of violent crime. To be anti-death penalty doesn't mean we're anti-victims or we're anti-justice. It's just to say that we can do better than killing to show that killing is wrong. With the death penalty, I mean, it's one of those things that a lot of people don't think a whole lot about, but the more you start looking at it, the more troubling it gets, especially when we look at our racial history, you know, the legacy of slavery and racism. I mean, where executions are happening right now is exactly where lynchings were happening 100 years ago. And the states that have held on to the death penalty the longest are the states that held on to slavery the longest. But you know what? What's also troubling is that Christians have, I think, really been the part of the problem on this. That 85% of executions in the last few decades have been in the Bible Belt. My buddy says the Bible Belt is the death belt. And wherever Christians have been most concentrated is where the death penalty has flourished. And that just messes with me, you know, as people who believe in redemption and grace. So at the end of the day, it raises some fundamental questions about faith too. And when I look at the Bible, I mean, one of the first murderers was Moses. So, I mean, he killed a dude, you know, and like, it's not really funny, but I mean, the fact is like the Bible, David, you know, killed Uriah, committed adultery with Bathsheba, Saul of Tarsus, you know, is it like terrorists. So the Bible's filled with messed up people, and the whole story is a story of grace and redemption and how good God's love is, you know, in spite of all the crazy things we do. And that's really what's at stake with the death penalty, I think, too.
What have your thoughts been about why Christianity is so associated with violence still? You spent a lot of time in the evangelical world. You grew up in the South. What are your thoughts about that? How does that happen?
Well, first of all, I think we've had a very narrow understanding of what it means to be pro-life. And for a lot of Christians, that has meant to be against abortion. And I think abortion is a really important issue, an incredibly important issue. But to me, pro-life doesn't just mean anti-abortion. It means being for life. You know, every person is created in the image of God. And I kind of wonder what would happen if Christians began to have a bigger framework for that, to where we thought anytime a life is destroyed, we lose a part of God's image in the world. That means we should be the biggest champions of life when it comes to gun violence, the movement for Black lives, you know, resistance to militarism and war and the death penalty and all of these things. These are issues of life. So that's part of what breaks my heart is some of us who would call ourselves Christians, we've often stood on the side of death rather than life. And as one who, when I look at Jesus, and Jesus is the lens through which I understand my Christianity, you know, he's the model for my life and the one I think, you know, came to show us what God is like. And it's becomes very difficult to reconcile violence with Jesus. You know, I've been saying like any death penalty, pro-death penalty Christian has a nagging problem of Jesus to deal with. Because when you look at Jesus and Jesus, you know, saying in as much as you forgive, you will be forgiven. Like, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. And love your enemies. Like, I'm pretty sure he meant we shouldn't kill them, you know. And yet, like, that's what we've seen is that sometimes we've been the champions of something different. But if you look at Jesus on the cross, I mean, we see what love looks like when it stares evil in the face. And Jesus says, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And I think when it comes to the death penalty in particular, it's so important to understand Jesus as one who was executed, you know, and that the significance of that, that Jesus turned a cross, which was only known like the electric chair, as a symbol of torture and horrific humiliation. I mean, the most violent thing that the state could do, and it was a horrific form of death. And now, like, Jesus triumphed over that death and put it, as Colossians says, on display. You know, he put death on display and triumphed over it with love and grace and forgiveness. And so that one of the images I use is that Jesus was like water poured on the electric chair to short circuit the whole system of death. And I think anytime we rejoice in death, we disgrace Jesus and the cross, because what Jesus was doing was exposing the most horrific violence that we are capable of, enduring it and triumphing over that with love. Black folks understood that during the periods of lynching. They called Jesus the first lynchee, you know, and it was this incredible act of divine solidarity with the most marginalized and despised people in our world. And they saw Jesus hanging from a tree, you know, and turning this horror into hope. And now we look at the cross and we see a conduit of God's love. But that's a testament, I think, of what Jesus did. And it should change the way that we think about death. I think in the way that we think about the death penalty in particular, is if every week or every day we're identifying with a forgiving victim of violence, a state violence, then it should make us suspicious of violence. You know, it should make us champions of grace and forgiveness. So that's what I hope for, you know. And this is different, you know, there's a generational thing to this, Michael. You know, I think where, like, there's a lot of young Christians, millennials were polled, and like 80% of them were against the death penalty because they can't reconcile it with Jesus. But there's still a lot of, I think, fundamentalism that looks back at the Old Testament and says, well, God put the death penalty in place. But then when you take a closer look, there's 30 death-worthy crimes in Scripture, you know? So like one of them was working on the Sabbath. You know, like people would be in big trouble. Like everybody but Chick-fil-A would be in the, you know, hot seat on that one. So like, but, you know, like,
well, Chick-fil-A works on the Sabbath. They just don't work on the Lord's day. So
that's right. Thank you. But you know, like 30 death-worthy crimes, and even in the U.S., like some of those were in place. That's where we have the Salem witch trials. You know, like witchcraft or sorcery. I mean, all kinds of things were listed on there. And I don't know many people that want to bring that death penalty back, you know, like the way it was. And so there's also the idea of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, which I think we've used to be used as a license for revenge. And it was just the opposite. The closer you look at that idea, it was a limitation of how much you could retaliate. So you could return equal harm for the harm done for you. But it put a limit on that so that you didn't continue to escalate, you know, and legitimate violence. And then Jesus comes, and that's where Jesus is a fulfillment of all this. He goes, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, but I tell you, turn the other cheek. You know, don't even hurt the person that hurts you. And I mean, that's a really incredible way of thinking, is that we may have a right to harm someone who's harmed us, but God's justice may be even bigger than we ever imagined, like, and more graceful than we ever imagined. So I think Jesus, like, is the lens through which I, like, read the whole Bible and how I, like, understand the world we live in. And to me, that's where Jesus really becomes the force for grace and forgiveness in all this. And the early Christians understood that. They spoke unilaterally against violence in a lot of different forms, but capital punishment was one of those, where they said over and over, they said things like, when someone kills a person, we consider it a crime, but why do we call it a noble virtue or justice when the state does it, or when we do it in mass, you know, in the military? Like how do we then make violence a virtue? So I love the early Christians on that. I mean, it probably didn't hurt that they were also like victims of execution, so they weren't big fans of it.
I've often wondered how our view of the cross and how our view of the role that punishment plays in the fulfillment of justice theologically ends up creating an environment where pro-life can mean against abortion, but for the death penalty, Because if you understand that God is loving and just, and the way God fulfills justice is punishing transgression or punishing crime, that view of justice becomes a lens with which you view the cross, you view salvation, and then you ultimately view earthly justice, where kind of as you alluded to with restorative justice and other lenses that we could view justice as a concept through, that can reinform our theology, reinform our public policy, and reinform really the way we view life itself.
Yeah, when I look at the biblical idea of justice, and you know, some of my friends that are smarter than me that actually read the Bible in its original languages and stuff, you know, they said that this idea of righteousness and justice were the same fundamental concept, even the same phrase. And the best translation that we have of the idea of righteousness and justice is restorative justice. We've been conditioned to think of justice as like, what did someone do wrong and what do they deserve as punishment for that crime? And I think God's justice is much deeper and more beautiful, and it's asking a different set of questions. It's asking what harm was done and how do we heal that, the wounds of that injustice, you know, and that also is about healing the person in the community that was harmed and the one who did the harm. You know, maybe the community has a responsibility in healing those wounds as well. And I look at places like Rwanda that have become really some of the exemplary models of restorative justice, and the Rwandan genocide, where hundreds of thousands of people were being killed, has become sort of a mirror to the world of what restorative justice can look like. And now some of the people that were responsible for that were not killed, but they're actually rebuilding the country that they destroyed. And there's amazing stories of forgiveness and grace. I was over there, and there are families that their children were killed in the genocide, and now they've adopted, over the years, some of the folks that responsible for the genocide and are raising them. And you look at that and it looks beautiful. And I think we haven't even allowed the possibilities of our imagination on some of those, because we've been so confined to one version of justice, you know, is just, you know, what did they do wrong? What do they deserve? And I think that's really a different way of thinking about justice than this whole scripture is more at putting things at one again, healing the things. And it's even where we get kind of the idea of atonement, you know, at one moment, some like simplify it to being that, you know. But like one version of God healing all things is that God needed more blood, you know, that humanity was doomed. And so it's kind of like God had a gun pointed at us and then took the gun off of us and pointed it at Jesus and killed Jesus. And some of those versions can end up creating a God that is very easy to fear, but very hard to love. And the God I know and the God I see in Jesus is actually love incarnate, and not, you know, so that I think how we understand Jesus's death has it very much can shape how we think about God, you know. And so these are huge questions, but they're so important, you know. I think they're questions that they affect the way that we live too, because we tend to imitate the God that we worship. So if we think God is throwing lightning bolts down like Zeus or something, you know, it makes us want to, you know, whoop out a can too. You know, so yeah.
Well, it's this idea that if we take justice and put it in opposition of love, it's almost like God is wrestling with God's self in any encounter with humanity. But I think, like, as you've kind of alluded to, like, maybe the most scriptural depiction of justice is restorative. I mean, I've been studying the story of the prodigal a lot lately. In the original cultural context, the prodigal son committed capital crimes. And yeah. When he returned, the father rushed to restore him and restore him fully. This might be a little bit of a stretch or a misread of the parable, but you have the older son who is disappointed in the form of justice that the father chose to administer. But the father very clearly says, that's not what I mean by justice. What I'm looking for is for this family to be whole.
Yeah. And you look at some of the most horrendous injustices and travesties in the world, like the Rwandan genocide or the Holocaust, or you know, apartheid South Africa, and there's a lot of ethicists that say what happened is there became a death fatigue. People got just absolutely so tired and worn down by violence and death that they realized the solution to this is not to mirror what has done so much harm. We can do better than that. So like after apartheid fell, the new South Africa had no space for the death penalty. After the Holocaust, in fact, like there wasn't the death penalty, and Jewish folks have kind of done away with the death penalty. And in part because I think that they've seen that death is the disease, not the cure. You know, death is the problem, not the solution. So if we're going to heal that, we don't really do an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Like we don't rape people who raped to show that rape is wrong. You know, if you poke my eye out, I wouldn't actually poke your eye out. That would seem kind of cruel, you know. And yet in the most extreme case of murder, we still try to show, you know, kill to show that killing is wrong. And I think there's a whole lot of the world that's discovered we can do better than that. You know, there's all kinds of ways that we can take evil seriously. We can take violence shouldn't go without consequences, but there's a whole lot of ways that we can contain violence without mirroring it. You know, we can, there's over 140 countries that have moved on from the death penalty, and we just keep, we happen to be one of the few that's holding on to it. And you know, it's important because this is the company that we keep when it comes to countries that execute the most people. China is number one. Number two is Iran, and then Iraq, and then Saudi Arabia, and then the U.S. is number five. Like, those are not known as champions of human rights, you know, and justice. So, you know, like, and so I think we, part of what we really can do, and it's going to take a generation, I think, to move on this and to create a groundswell that says we can do better than this form of justice. And that doesn't mean that we just let people run free, or that someone like Dylann Roof doesn't deserve punishment for what he did, or that doesn't have consequences. But when we kill, we stoop to the morality that we're actually trying to teach our kids, you know, don't do that. And when the state does it, it kind of reinforces some kind of like distorted view, I think, of justice.
Since 1995, the United States of America has executed 1,454 people. Executions peaked in 1999, with 98 inmates executed in a single year. The South is the leader by far, with 1,186 executions, though Texas and Oklahoma executed more than their share, with 654 people. Most executions happen via lethal injection, though 8 states allow execution, including my native Florida, and 3 allow hanging. 2 states still allow firing squads, but unlike Utah, Oklahoma only uses firing squads as a backup in the event other methods are found unconstitutional. Race plays a significant role in the application of the death penalty. Black people are overrepresented on death row by a factor of 3 when compared to the general population. Studies have shown that, depending on the state, a defendant is 2 to 3.5 times more likely to receive the death penalty for killing a white person as they are for killing a black person. The first DNA exoneration occurred in 1989. 350 people have been freed from death row by DNA evidence, and 37 of those 350 pled guilty to their crime. 71% of these cases involved an eyewitness misidentification, and 41% involved a cross-racial witness misidentification. 46 involved a misapplication of forensic science, and 28%, over 1 in 4, involved false confessions. More than half of these false confessors were 21 or younger at the time of the arrest. On average,
Inmates exonerated by DNA evidence spent 14 years in incarceration before DNA evidence revealed their total innocence. Of the 350 people exonerated by DNA, 217 were black, 106 were white, 25 were Latinos, and 2 were Asian Americans. For more information about the death penalty, DNA exoneration, and the injustice represented by the death penalty, visit innocenceproject.org or deathpenaltyinfo.org.
There's a lot of misinformation out there. So the more I started looking into stuff, the more troubled you become, because like there's a study of hundreds of police chiefs, and they were asked, what are the most effective deterrents of violent crime? They listed all kinds of different things, but the death penalty was like the very bottom of the list. You know, it didn't even virtually register. And part of what they said is like, we're dealing with like really, really wicked stuff sometimes. And like Dylann Roof in Charleston, you know, he doesn't like think, oh, I might get the death penalty for this. I don't think I'm actually going to shoot these people. You know, it goes much deeper than that. And so I think that there are a whole lot of ways that we can have a safer, more sensible society. Like, what really captivated me on this was not just the statistics, because I don't know too many people that get argued into thinking differently, but it was the stories, you know. And I mean, just a few days ago, I was with Ron, who is with Witness to Innocence, which is all folks that were wrongfully convicted and they were sentenced to death. Ron was in a motorcycle group going across the country, and they were in this kind of envoy of motorcycles, drove through a town, and there had been a murder. They had no idea, but they were swarmed by police, arrested, and they didn't even know what they were being charged with. They said, geez, can we see a judge? Can we be put on trial? Because we don't even know what's going on here. They were put on trial, and they were convicted and sentenced to death. I mean, they're just like deer in the headlights. And come to find out, like years later, 9 days from Ron's execution, 9 days away, a police officer confessed to the crime, and there had been a whole cover-up operation. The sheriff was involved. They actually found the weapon. It was locked in a safe. Like, all the evidence was there, and they had pinned it on these motorcycle guys, like, to cover up a police officer's crime, and they were willing to kill 4 people to do that. And you look at that, and you're like, my gosh, you know. But then the more you look, I mean, there's 155 other people like Ron that have been wrongfully sentenced to death, some of them hours from their execution, and later proved innocent. And that's just the ones that have been able to prove it, you know. And you hear stories like that, and it raises so many questions about a lot of things. I mean, for every 9 executions, we've had 1 exoneration, 1 person proved innocent. You're like, man, what if every 10 planes that took off, one of them crashed? You know, we'd be like, whoa, time out, you know. But and it's people's lives that are destroyed through that. I mean, cumulatively, it's almost 1,800 years that have been taken from those 156 people that were wrongfully convicted, because it takes over 10 years to prove your innocence. So the issue of innocence, how much we trust the state, you know, do we trust our government with the irreversible power over life and death? And that's, you know, why a lot of conservatives have really jumped on board with the abolition movement. But a lot of times we think that we're killing the worst of the worst, but we're really killing the poorest of the poor. And what determines who gets executed is often not the atrocity of the crime, but the resources of the defendant to defend himself or herself. And that, just, I think, for any one of us that loves Jesus and cares about the poor, that is very disturbing and troubling.
What do you think about the differences between systematic and cultural and political ethics and morality versus individual? Because, you know, we've been talking about like how Jesus responds to people. a lot of people's response is, you know, yeah, as an individual, you're supposed to love your neighbor and forgive your neighbor. But as a society, you know, how could a society function without a military? How could a society function that just says, you know, yeah, if you bomb our country, we'll just forgive you and turn the other cheek? And they extend that to sort of give the state carte blanche of whatever violence it wants to use. How do you guys think about those tensions and those lines between, you know, mandating some sort of personal ethic of nonviolence on a larger scale, the practicalities of that, the complications of that, and how do you see that in play in this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a great question. And it's, I think this is one of the really weird things that we have differentiated is personal ethics and social, you know, ethics or government. Like somehow it's like our governments are holier than people are, you know, or sin doesn't affect systems. It only affects people. And, you know, I interviewed an executioner in the middle of this, and I never even really thought about what it does to folks who are responsible for taking, for doing the dirty work of executing someone. Talked to this guy, Ron McAndrew. He's a former prison warden. He oversaw executions in Florida. During one of the electric chair executions, the man's head caught on fire, and he was horrified. And he was like, I was done with the electric chair, but he said, I still believed in the death penalty. I'd been so conditioned to believe in the death penalty. His response was to go to Texas and get trained in lethal injection and bring it back to Florida. And when he did that, he was still haunted by the folks that he killed. In fact, in his own words, he said, they visited me in my sleep. He said, I drank myself to sleep. I was absolutely haunted by my job as executioner. And in the end, he ended up being against the death penalty. And he's an expert witness now about cruel and unusual punishment. But it's his faith that led him there. You know, he said, there's no good way to kill people. And, you know, when we do that, we feel it really begin to squash the good in us. When we take life, it kills a part of us. And I've heard the same thing, you know, from soldiers that come back and they said, I went to Iraq and Afghanistan. I thought, you know, I'm going to get rid of terrorism. But they said, I felt like we were creating it. It was like we were pouring fuel on the fire. And that's exactly what Dr. King said. You know, is you don't fight fire with fire. You don't fight hatred with hatred. Love is the way to do this. Like, nonviolence overcomes violence, and violence begets the very thing that it seeks to get rid of. And so a lot of soldiers that come back from Iraq that I'm friends with, they said, I felt like I was trying to carry a gun in one hand and a cross in the other. And I was trying to serve two masters, and there just wasn't a way to reconcile the cross and the message of Jesus to love our enemies and simultaneously be ready at any minute to kill them. Like, I just couldn't do that. And it's created, you know, what a lot of folks are calling like a moral injury, like an injury of conscience in them as they feel this kind of collision in their souls. So I think we can do a lot better in the world too, as we think of what it means to seek God's kingdom, that when we continue to fight violence with violence, we continue to add fuel to the fire of violence in the world. You know, what does it mean to love our enemies in a world of ISIS? Folks say, well, that's impractical. I'm like, I mean, Jesus said that to people that were being fed to beasts in the arena and being hung upside down on crosses. I mean, evil was real 2,000 years ago, and it's real today. And I think part of what the problem is that we haven't had the courage to take the cross as seriously as we've taken the sword. We haven't had the courage, you know, to be willing to die loving our enemies as we have being willing to die ready to kill them.
If you like the Liturgist podcast, but you would like to dive deeper by connecting with people in flesh and blood rather than just listening to voices all the time, we would love to see you at one of our Liturgist gatherings. We're hosting three of them this year. We're going to be in Los Angeles, California, September 15th and 16th, Boston, Massachusetts, October 6th and 7th, and Seattle, Washington, October 27th and 28th. These gatherings are always such a great time. We've done several of them, and the big thing is you guys meeting each other and being together. There's always fascinating and brilliant people. that attend these things. And then you'll also have Science Mike and I doing the weird stuff that we like to do, having existential conversations. We're going to host some liturgy moments with you, some meditations. We'll sing together a little bit, join around the table. Every one of these is kind of unique and take on sort of the vibe of the place and the people that are there. You can get tickets at theliturgists.com. You can just go to the events page. Also, there you'll be able to see Gungor events and Science Mike events as well. Gungor, for instance, is going on a little acoustic tour again this summer, as well as a couple of full band dates like in Dallas and New York City as well. For the Gungor tour, I know they're still working on getting some of the ticket links up, so keep an eye on that if you'd like. But if you're in the United States, Gungor's probably going to be somewhere near you in July or August. But if you want the full deal with Science Mike and Gungor and, most importantly, other liturgists, the gatherings in Los Angeles, Boston, and Seattle really are going to be the best thing for you. So do check it out on the website, theliturgists.com/events. And we look forward to seeing you in person. We do think these events are going to be really helpful for you. See you soon.
With the bomb strapped to his chest, with a bullhorn in hand, they both bow their heads and pray to do God's will, fulfill the faith, and walk into the crowd. Outsiders are wrong. If your questions don't belong, if your doubt is called a sin and you're not to search within, let it go. Open your eyes and let me.
It's so strange to me how comfortable we get with violence. And like when you use the example, Shane, of, you know, we don't repay rapists with rape. If that was proposed, people would just be horrified, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if you said, no, we should do that so they know what it's like, people, it'd just be automatically, oh my God, you couldn't do something like that to somebody. But why is it that murder and killing someone violently is seen as less than that somehow? Like, we're more comfortable with that. I remember going to the movies recently and seeing, just looking at the posters, and I couldn't see a poster where I was standing. Every single poster had like a gun,
yeah,
or some sort of violence on it. It's what we celebrate in this culture. It's like the hero that went and killed everybody. You know, it's like somebody has made the observation that you don't have rape mystery parties. You have,
oh man,
murder mystery parties where it's kind of fun and romantic. Who murdered the person? And it's like this kind of fun social thing to do. But imagine a rape mystery party where it's like, who raped so-and-so in the study? Like, why do we consider murder and killing so light and carefree? Like, it's just something that we do. That's disturbing.
I'm with you, dude. And I mean, when we look at our country too, I think sometimes it becomes so normalized that it's everywhere. You know, it's in our video games, it's in so much messaging, even in our language, you know, like killing time. And, you know, there's just, I mean, I'm not like a prude, but I'm saying, I think it gets in us, you know, it gets inside of us. And then, I mean, we live in a country where I was just looking at Guinness Book of World Records. And one of the records that I was flipping the page, you know, looking at it with a kid, and I flipped the page and it said most guns, and it's the U.S. by far has the most civilian-owned guns, and it's like almost one per person. We've got about 300 million guns. And the next country, it was, I think, India, where it was 4 guns for every 100 people or something like that. Like, it's just insane. Oh. Like the world that we're living in, like, we become normalized that this is normal. And you realize, my gosh, like, where there's more guns, more people get killed with guns. You know, like, more people commit suicide. We got 90 people a day who are dying from guns. And, you know, the solution to that, I think this is where, like, it gets so vicious, is we say, well, what do you do? Well, the answer to a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. We need more guns, you know? And so we just keep, like, this, you know, Jesus's language is, if you pick up the sword, you die by the sword. You know, like, we keep doing that, and it keeps killing us. It's literally killing us. 30,000 people a year in our country that are dying from gun violence. And you know, my friends that own guns, like, they're like, well, it's not a gun problem, it's a heart problem. I'm like, why can't it be both? I mean, I think sin is real. Like, violence is real. It's in my heart too. You know, I have to deal with that too. But, like, it's a lot harder to kill someone with a spoon, you know, and or violence in my neighborhood, you know, and in our country, it's unprecedented in a lot of parts of the world. So I think we can do better, you know. And Jesus points us towards that, you know. The Bible doesn't have a whole lot to say about the right to bear arms, but it's got a whole lot to say about loving our enemies. And I think that's where we've got to really come back to the centering on Jesus. You know, Peter, I like Peter because he, you know, when the soldiers come for Jesus, he picks up a sword and cuts one of their ears off. Jesus looks back at him and scolds him, puts the ear back on the dude. And the early Christians understood that so powerfully. They said, when Jesus disarmed Peter, he disarmed every Christian. Because if ever there was a case for redemptive violence to protect the innocent, like, Peter had the strongest case in the world. He's protecting Jesus. And Jesus scolds him and heals the person that he hurt. So that's, I think, why we see, you know, perfect love in Jesus is nonviolent. And it's also what the disciples were committed to. You know, they said grace can dull even the sharpest sword. So I think there's a whole lot of ways that we can become a healthier society, but we got to hit it on all fronts. You know, I think we've got to take on the spiritual, like, hard issues, but we've also got to take on some of the issues like guns that you can access. You know, folks that can't fly on airplanes can get a gun. In Philly, you can get guns that have the capacity to shoot 100 rounds in a minute. You know, and kids in my neighborhood, when I was like, why would you have a gun like that? You can't shoot a deer with that, you know, and it's a great question. Should we even have things like that? So one of the first folks I met before I had even really started researching for the book is a guy named Billy Neil Moore. And what's interesting about Billy's case is his guilt is not in question. He took someone's life. He came back from Vietnam really troubled. Not the least of his worries was financial. And so he and a army buddy kind of got together, and they thought they had a foolproof plan to get some easy money. No one would get hurt. They were going to rob this house. And prior to this, Billy had never had any criminal history, nothing like that. And so they went to rob this house, and things went totally haywire, and the homeowner was killed. And Billy Neil Moore was haunted with what they were responsible for. And so he turned himself in, confessed fully to the crime, knew that he would face the death penalty. And what's interesting is Billy said, that was fine with me. I had no reason to live. I thought I deserved the death penalty. And he said, if I could have pushed the button on my own execution, I would have done it. He tried to kill himself while he was in prison. But then there was an interruption, and it came from the most unlikely place you would think. It was the victim's family. They were Christians, and they got to know Billy, and they said, listen, we hate what you did. You took someone from us that we loved so much, and we will never get them back. And they said, but We want you to know we believe in Jesus. We believe in second chances. We believe in forgiveness and redemption. And so they said, we're going to argue against the death penalty for you. And it was incredible to watch like their relationship. In fact, Billy committed his life to Jesus. He got baptized while he was in prison. This family became kind of his surrogate family, and they were one of the biggest opponents of the death penalty in his case, the victim's family. And it was a really exceptional case because not only was Billy's life spared, but he was eventually released from prison. And today he's a pastor, and I get to preach with him every chance I get. And when he preaches the gospel, it is the very heart of Jesus, that no one is beyond redemption. You know, I think part of why I have such a passion about this is for a lot of my life, I was for the death penalty. And in fact, I can remember in high school and debating on the other side of this issue, and really, like, I felt like I was running some liberals in the ground, you know, and I had the Bible on my side. I had so much going for me. So that gives me a little bit of compassion because I see where people are coming from. I see why, like, people are inclined to be supportive of the death penalty. And a lot of folks, you know, haven't met the stories. They haven't come face to face with the real people that I think are directly affected by this. The last story I'll tell too is, you know, as I was finishing up the book, I went to Minneapolis and I met this woman who everybody was like, oh, she's a legend. You got to meet Mary Johnson, you know. So they took me to meet her, and her story starts really hard. Her son was killed in Minneapolis in a random shooting on the street. It was her only son. She was horrified, obviously, like, instinctively wanted the harshest form of justice, you know, of punishment for the person. They found the young man that had killed her son. Then over time, like, she really just she's kind of a charismatic, little bit of a Pentecostal woman. She says the Spirit started to work on her, and then there was this kind of like wild moment where she read this poem, and she gave me a copy of it. It's an anonymous poem. No one even knows who wrote it, but it's these two heavenly women that are talking to each other, and they can tell, you know, it's kind of got this surreal angelic feel, but the two women have a blue tint to their halos, and that means that they had lost their children on earth. And one of the women realizes that she's talking to Mary, the mother of Jesus, you know. So she's like, oh my gosh, you're Mary, the mother of Jesus. And Mary says back to her, tell me about yourself. And the other woman says, I'm the mother of Judas Iscariot, you know, the one who betrayed Jesus and then killed himself. And they embrace one another. And Miss Johnson, when she read this in Minneapolis, she said, I realized that there's another mother and I want to get to know her. So she got to know O'Shea, the young man who killed her own son. She got to know his mother. And over the years, she really got to know O'Shea, the young man who was responsible for the crime. And they started an organization called Two Mothers. And one of them leads a support group for women whose children have been murdered. And the other leads a support group for children who have been responsible for violent crimes. And all of them are healing together. And now when O'Shea, when the young man who did that crime, when he was eventually released from prison years later, one of his first things that he said as he was released from prison is, I feel like the luckiest man in the world to have two mothers. And he ended up living next door to Mary, the mother of the young man who he had killed. And that, when I look at that story, like, to me, it's got the marks of the Spirit of God all over it. It's about restoration and about healing. And I think we need more stories like that one.
If you'd like more of Shane Claiborne's thoughts on the death penalty, he wrote a book called Executing Grace, Why It's Time to Put the Death Penalty to Death. Well, we've heard some heart warming and moving stories. We've had some beautiful faith expressed by Shane Claiborne. I think it's about that time of the show when it's time for
Epistemological Breakdown.
Am I sounding particularly Christian today?
I think we both are. Real Jesus-y vibe in this one. A lot of Jesus thrown around.
It's called Christian violence. I mean, it makes sense.
I am a Christian, so it does make some sense.
So when we talk about violence, I think it's really easy to simplify and think in categorizations, just like everything else. For some reason, it seems really difficult for human beings sometimes to deal with paradox and to deal with complexity. I mean, like the idea of light being both a particle and a wave is only a problem for us. You know, it's like, it's not a problem for light.
I've never heard it stated that way, but that's quite correct, yes.
It's only a problem for our constructs, for our thoughts, for our words and perspectives. And so we want to think one thing is a thing. And so we say, is it a particle or a wave?
Well, we have such an enlightenment zeal to make all of our rhetoric axiomatic and to have ideas being axiomatic being a demonstration of their trustworthiness or truth claim. And reality keeps bucking our expectations of axiomatic systems describing accurately.
Yeah. So we talk about something like violence, and it becomes a dichotomy then of nonviolence or just war. Is it okay sometimes, or is violence evil? I don't know. I guess the way I sort of see things, there's kind of this paradox and this tension at the heart of when you talk about something like violence. Because without violence, we don't exist. Without death, there is no life. Every meal that we eat is taking a life, taking a lot of life, whether you're vegan or not. To live is to take life from something else. That's rough. That's at the heart of it all. I hold that sometimes violence is a necessary, not sometimes, it's always a necessary part of life on some level. But I also find that a stand against violence, a stand for nonviolence, a stand for peace and harmony and for life is also at the center of it all. To hold both of those things in tension, it's both a particle and a wave sort of thing. To say, yes, the way of Jesus is nonviolent. The way of a healthy, beautiful spirituality. The way to be a full human being, alive and present to life and bringing shalom into the world is to stand against violence with peace, to enact a different sort of embodiment in the world that is nonviolent. And I think holding both of those things to be true. So is violence evil? Yes. Is the better way nonviolence? Yes. Is violence necessary sometimes? Yes. You know what I mean? Like it's all yes. And it's complicated and it's complex and we don't like that because that's a problem with us, not necessarily with reality.
For me, the larger question, like that fits in that framework, is violence good or bad? It's when or under what circumstances is violence necessary? And that cuts a much more subtle and nuanced line than either, you know, warmongering or absolute pacifism. And even the idea that violence is evil, I you have to like accept a certain number of of assumptions to say that, right? Like, so like if it is a lion killing violently, killing a gazelle and eating it, is that evil? Mm-hmm. Well, I think most people would say no.
Well, from the perspective of the gazelle.
Right. Well, the gazelle, it's a real bad time. But like from the perspective of a herd of gazelles, it's not necessarily a bad time because it does create this pressure where the limited number of calories from vegetation go to the healthiest gazelles that are the best outrunning lions, which ultimately kind of tunes them better for the environment. And don't hear that as an argument for social Darwinism. I'm not making that leap. So part of that's endemic to how mammalian brains, especially predatory mammalian brains, function. But then in the question of like, when is violence justified, I almost think unless you're on the far ends of the poles of human behavior, the answer is almost always difficult to arrive at because it's not axiomatic, right? Like, so clearly using violence or force to intervene, someone being assaulted.
Yeah.
Like, I can't understand that level of pacifism. Mm-hmm. That to say no, even that's not appropriate. But then at what point does violence fit this label we use, evil? I don't know that it's always cut and dry.
I don't think it's ever cut and dry. I mean, but even thinking about a word like justified, he said, is the violence justified? By what metric and to what ends?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I was going to say, okay, then justifiable, but still.
It still assumes some sort of larger assumed thing, you know, like either a biblical or a ethical or a moral black and white that can be adhered to or not adhered to. So that's what it is. It's messy, but that's why for me, like even the lion eating the gazelle, is there, when I say a word like evil, I have to recognize that that's just a construct coming from a certain perspective. The knowledge of good and evil is this human condition. So as such, like the idea of necessary evil, again, from the perspective of the gazelle or from the perspective of even me watching the gazelle, the lion eating the gazelle is an evil of sorts. It is there's a pain and a suffering that it creates in me because I don't want that to happen. It creates pain in the gazelle. There's something, I don't know, from a certain perspective, it is evil, but it's also necessary. Is it any given act of violence? Is it the right or the wrong thing? It depends where you're looking from and what you're trying to do. This is probably unsettling for people because then how can you say, I mean, you could take that into horribly vile justifications of violence because everybody that enacts violence, I'm sure, feels justified on some level.
So this is like why our evangelical friends are always sounding the alarm against moral relativism. Because if you create the right set of observational points or the right perspective, you can justify almost any action. And that's actually why I love the Christian faith.
Yeah.
Like this metaphor of the garden and that the major event that happens is the knowledge of good and evil. Even other animals with large cranial capacities and high intelligence don't seem to wrestle with what is and is not ethical as much as we do.
Yeah.
Not even a tiny percentage of how much time we spend thinking about it. This is something that defines the human condition. And so then we start to explore, you know, through linguistic models of reality, what is right, what is wrong. And that absolutely, the root of that is violence and the threat of violence. So many ethicists say that governments build their authority on the threat of violence. That's the seat of power for government institutions. And as simple as it is, that's what draws me to the Christian faith specifically and the Gospels, when you have this library of books in the Bible, and then it gets distilled down into love God and love your neighbor. And so then when you start to explore the question of violence through the perspective of, does this love your neighbor? You absolutely have to take a very reticent approach to violence and to war and to force. Because in that situation, the only way I see violence as being justified is when you are doing what must be done to prevent someone from being harmed. It should always be done with great hesitation, with great care, and with ultimately a perspective of restoration and not retribution.
Yeah, it comes down to like what kind of organisms do we want to be on some level? Like, I watched Alien this last week, and a friend invited me to go, and I said yes, kind of without thinking about it. And then I thought about it, and I'm like, why am I going to this movie? I don't like movies like this. But I'd already said yes. I was like, oh.
I'm going to guess there was a little violence in the Alien film.
There was a little violence in it. But it, of course, I was kind of existential while watching it. Because yeah. I was like, there's this fear, everybody's, I won't give any spoilers, other than that there is an alien that kills people. When we show these films where there's this terrifying other creature that eats humans and just attacks, and we have this like fear of it, it's the dark music, and it's this feels like this really evil thing. And I'm watching it like, that's, what's any different about that than what we are? You know, we walk around as aliens, but we're just, our human beings are the chickens and the pigs and the cows. We just, come in and slit their throats. And we're very organism-centric, you know. This, every individual organism is its own universe of sorts for itself. And so what kind of things, what kind of people, kind of organisms do we want to be? And we've seen in history certain ways of being human that there's something in us that says, no, we don't want to be a species of Genghis Khan's and Hitler's and Stalin's. Now, like I said, we don't want to be a bunch of people that just are trying to kill whatever and whoever stands in our way to power and the pinnacle of whatever sort of lifestyle and comfort we want. It's better to have love. It's better to love not just the powerful and those who have something to offer us that make our lives more economically empowered or whatever, but also the people who are under us in the socioeconomic ladder and power systems, the oppressed and the poor and the marginalized. To show love there is to value the core of what we are and who we are and the core of everything, and to honor life and to love life, which is the same thing as to love ourselves. How can we love ourselves if we don't love our neighbor? You know, it kind of all goes together. This love, this experience of human love, dictates nonviolence. It when you follow it through, to love yourself is to not want to go to war with your neighbor. If you really love yourself truly and love who you are and what you are, it is to love your neighbor. I think of those, goodness, 1 John, pulling out some Bible again. Love is of God. Everyone that love is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not, I'm like quoting a song in my head. Oh, my children's church song. If you don't love your brother, you don't love God. If you don't love your neighbor, you don't love God. You don't love yourself. It all goes together. So to love God is to love a way of nonviolence. Still, there's times that you got to eat. And so how can you engage in the tension of and the paradox of that in a way that you can still hold on to love? Some of it is letting go of those really strict fundamentalist structures in my brain between ideas like love and violence. And somehow when I eat, if I'm grateful to the food that gave its life and is giving its life for me as a manifestation of love and grace and God, you see that there's tension in it and it's a little messy and a little tricky, but it's still aimed towards the kind of human that I want to be, which is what I see as well in the Christian story and in the story of Jesus, who suffers violence on a cross, who offers his body and his blood to the world, and who we take that as our food of sorts, as grace. I think that's interesting when you think about how those things tie together with the Christian proclivity to violence
and how that, when it's beautiful, is a direction towards love, love of yourself, love of your neighbor, love of God. And somehow that turns into a fear-based us and them, a violence towards those who are perceived as underneath us, maybe the unbelievers or the heretics or the whatever. And there's this separation and this fear rather than love that actually separates us. Love pulls us away into ourselves with fear and violence. It's interesting how that turns, how Christian violence, such an ironic and unfortunate perversion of Christianity.
If you take a particular read of the Hebrew Bible, wherein there are the chosen, and the chosen are constantly under threat from outsiders and tasked with protecting and preserving the word of God, and then you filter that through a New Testament where the center of gravity is in like Revelation, It's very easy to take the meta narrative of the Bible and of the narrative of the early church fathers being persecuted for their faith and to craft this us or them. And we take this image, and I think almost instead of over under, it's you'd imagine a city surrounded by a wall with a dome over it. And there's two kinds of threats. There's lateral threats, kind of outsiders coming towards you, which, you know, today would be those atheists. That would be Islam. This would be people equal to us, but opposed to the gospel. And then the kind of coming from above threats would be more like the way the government persecutes. And I think in a modern Western Protestant context, that looks like what Rachel Held Evans calls the Christian persecution industrial complex, where there's this entire cottage industry of taking that read, that meta-narrative of Scripture, and then interpreting current events in a way that makes people of faith feel afraid of outsiders, makes people of faith be fearful of a gay couple that just wants to get married and have a cake at their wedding, and that gets interpreted as violence directed toward them, which then potentially becomes justification for economic violence, social violence, or overt physical violence. You see this in a popular support among Christians, especially evangelicals, but Christians in general, for militaristic intervention in the Middle East. A majority of Americans support these drone strikes that happen. You know, this is really, really horrible stuff. You know, we have reports of children being killed by bombs and missiles that have been issued from drone strikes. But it's justified because Islam's not a religion of peace. The Muslims are out to create a false theocratic order in America. And if we don't act, we will be overcome. And this comes from that siege mentality, turning Scripture on its head. Doing what, by the way, evangelicals say was the problem with the Old Testament, where the Jewish people were chosen to be the messengers of God, and they just thought they were the chosen. And even though that's a critique I've heard in conservative churches, that's actually what's happening in the Western church today. Mm. Jesus demonstrated what it meant to be chosen. Jesus showed us exactly what it meant to be chosen. It meant to lay down what was rightfully yours, to step down from power, to step down from authority, to eliminate these ideas of above and below. That's the beauty of the neighbor parable. Neighbors are, you're just neighbors. There's no hierarchy. There's no command structure. There's no authority. There's just neighbors.
Yeah, that fly in the ointment of the land and the chosen, It's pretty central to so much of the religion, to see how Jesus sort of, he came from the religion of Judaism, but he also sort of subverted it. You don't have that element so much in Buddhism or Hinduism or some of the Eastern religions, where there's like a piece of land that is supposed to belong to one people and a call of a single people group, whether it be through, you know, bloodline or belief, as it turns into in the New Testament. There's still sort of that center within Judeo-Christianity sometimes of the chosen people And that's, I think that's a dangerous idea and one that needs to be subverted. I've heard some Christians, the way they subvert it is by accentuating the blessed to be a blessing idea, that this group has received this blessing or this revelation or maybe even this plot of land for the sake of the world, to be able to use it to bless the world with. But yeah, it's always worth paying attention to how that meta-narrative that's so central to so many readings of the scriptures and approaches to religion and Christianity in particular. I think it's just important to stay aware of that. And how does it subtly creep in, even to progressive circles? And groups can be practically necessary things, sure. But if there's that sort of inner chosen people that are really on the in, any idea, even if that's where the really enlightened progressive ones, it's all that same shit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the national narrative too. The American narrative is we were given this land to bless the world.
Yeah.
Even though we took this land by force, enriched it with forced labor, then did not bless the world, right? But the narrative that justifies our existence is to be this, what is it, the shining city on a hill?
Mm-hmm.
But it's like if we're the shining city on a hill, the oil in our lamps came from human bodies. I know we've talked about nationalism on the show before, but there is this combination of the national narrative and the religious narrative. And in a very traditionalist value meme way, it becomes an unquestionable story. But I'm not sure that as Christians and as Americans, we can really come to terms with what violence means and the justification of violence until we come to terms with the role that violence has played in the country we live in becoming what it is, and the way that it enables and sustains the very life that many of us live. And that's a huge, huge issue to wrestle with. The outcomes and the path toward reconciliation and restoration and reparation are not clear. But I don't believe you can truly appreciate a conversation on violence until you study and come to terms with indigenous genocide in the Americas, or slavery, or economic violence and segregation, or the cradle-to-prison pipeline for Black Americans. All these things are related to how we systemically prescribe violence in our country. You know, Shane Claiborne did a great job talking about how that applies to the death penalty. That also just scratches the surface of a very deep well of just black tar, which is the structure of our country and therefore the religious institutions that reside within that political system are powered by violence. And not the I'm thankful for this animal who has given me energy way, but in the worst sort of exploitive, disgusting, dehumanizing violence against other organisms which also have tasted from the tree of knowledge and can contemplate what is right and what is wrong, and therefore must also contemplate, why is it I who is under the boot? Why is it I who feels this heel on my neck?
It's so easy in seeing that sort of violence. This is how violence gets cyclical, because we see it and we're disgusted by it. And it's so easy to dive into that tar and to then dehumanize the dehumanizers. You know, this is how the cycle of violence, it's like somebody did something that was horrible and we feel like it's justice to get in there and do the same to them and a little worse. And then somebody on that side feels the same way, and you just get into this cycle. And having a stance, a heart position of nonviolence, even when you feel like it's justified and the person who wronged you or wronged whoever is worthy of nothing but death because they've sullied their own image of God by becoming this animalistic, violent thing, and you see that, and then you make them this less than the image of God thing. And then without knowing it, you're doing the same to yourself, which, some, you know, it continues. About, so having this position of nonviolence, and not a position, feels like stationary. Position feels like axiomatic, language center based thought rather than a way of being. A way of being nonviolent, I think, always sees the divine in the enemy, always sees the human in the beast of the enemy and the oppressor and the person that is the bad guy. And it doesn't mean you just accept what they do or that there's nothing to be done and you just let people trample over people. And I learned a lot from the Buddhist way of thought with this idea of nonviolence, because the way I grew up, you know, for a long time I debated, am I a pacifist? And I considered myself a pacifist, but then it raises the issue of just war. And what if you see somebody attacking somebody on the street? Are you really not supposed to step in physically? If somebody came into my house and broke in, would I defend my family? All those questions, because it was this dichotomy created in my mind. And that was the sort of thinking that's enlightenment thinking and, you know, modern Western thinking. And the Buddhists, from what I've heard and studied and internalized at this point, is nonviolence all the way down to, you know, like, are you going to step on that flower if you don't have to step on it? There's a beautiful flower. You're going to just crush it without thought? Or are you going to? But see, for me, the way I came from, that would easily become like a fundamentalist. Okay, don't step on flowers. Mm. You know, like, and that's not the point. Like, if you step on a flower, a Buddhist kills billions of organisms a day with bacteria, you know, these all sorts of things dying on a microscopic level, on a plant level, animal level. There's all sorts of death surrounding every life again. But when you can, you're aimed, if your being is aimed towards nonviolence. I try not to kill insects in my, and I'm not going to try. If I see an insect in my house that I don't have to kill, if I can peacefully release it into the wild now, I do, which is not something I used to do. But I don't get weird about it. If there's a spider crawling towards my daughter and I don't feel good, I'll stomp on it. And maybe that's just because I still have work to do in myself. I don't know. But it's just become like, if I don't have to kill, my being is aimed towards nonviolence always. That's where I want to be. And it's not always that we had an anthill that an exterminator got rid of. And I felt sad about it. I felt sad that all these ants were killed. But I was also like, for us to just let these ants roam and take over our house would really create a lot of suffering for my family. It's tricky. It's messy. It's life.
Honestly, to explore that a little deeper, it's a decent analogy. There's a significant number of non-native invasive ant species in California that are destroying the indigenous life forms in California. Yeah. And yeah. So in some ways, a failure to respond to that nest could have a much higher cost in life in the region and life that's not as robust maybe or is more specialized and so doesn't have the same opportunity to spread to other places the way these invasive species have. And then there's this whole thing, the cycle of violence. And I think there's this great way of breaking the cycle of violence, which is outlined across the entire arc of the Bible. One is repentance. Repentance is actually an incredible tool for breaking a cycle of violence, because if you have been the most recent transgressor, you repent. You turn away from doing that anymore. But repentance also includes restitution. You do what you must to make amends with the party you have wronged, even if that included violence. That's one way of preventing the cycle of violence. And there's also the approach of Christ in the face of violence, which was to submit to the violence. Although I think there's some pretty good scholarly understanding that in part of what Jesus did in his submission to violence was an extremely powerful critique of that violence. To walk, you know, if you're told to walk a mile and you walk two. That's not simply to be kind and gregarious, but to reveal the brutality of the initial request. But either way, we're given these tools to break cycles of violence. But in the biblical arc that I see, it's not if they send one of yours to the hospital, send one of theirs to the morgue kind of approach we tend to embody. But restitution, we forget so much when we talk about violence and stopping violence. I don't see how it's possible without restitution, without some way of settling the score, because significant violence has generational consequences, especially when that physical violence has been attached to some ongoing economic violence.
So when you think about humanity sort of as a larger organism, as this one species, and you think of some of the bigger cycles and enactments of violence like war, you know, larger scale punitive justice systems and all this, I think there's always room on a systemic level and in the organism of humanity for, regardless of the situation, violence is not the answer. For the voice to be protesting every form of violence, regardless of whether it is justifiable or not. That even in a war that must be fought, there's a voice still there with their signs and saying violence is never the answer. That even though that might not be a practical thing for the rest of humanity to say, okay, let's just get rid of the militaries and on the borders and call it a day, that might not be a practical way that humanity could survive. But having the voice towards that end, always and persistently, is part of the balance of the system. It's like the immune system in a body is going to fight any foreign thing. And sometimes if your body gets a little screwed up and it sees a part of itself as the foreign thing, that immune system is still fighting. It's still doing what it does. It's still getting rid of that foreign invader. You know, it's this sort of constant direction of being towards nonviolence. Think of this as like this pacifist saying, no, you know, even if the invader comes into my house, I will not raise the sword. You don't want to be so hardline where it actually becomes violent in itself, but this constant no to violence, I think, has a value in society. And so I applaud the people that, even when it's impractical, I think there's something beautiful about, even if it costs everything, I will not pick up that sword. I think that's a beautiful thing to have in the organism.
I almost said, well, because, you know, I'm always like, above all, I seek balance. I was like, well, then I just wonder if I should explain the necessity for voices saying violence is necessary. And then realize you don't have to do that.
Yeah, that's
voices
humanity.
Are just there. Right. It's humanity. It's the nature of the species.
Yeah.
You're never going to find, like, will anyone advocate for violence in this situation?
Exactly.
Will someone stand up?
No. The more fragile flower is the nonviolent thing. That's the more rare and special attitude and movement of energy to have. The violence and I'm going to protect me and my own, that's deeper in the brain structure.
Yeah, that's the weeds you cannot keep from growing in your garden.
Well, on some level, it's the border of the garden itself. You couldn't have a garden without that on some level.
Yeah.
But to embrace the paradox of that is a challenging... It's a level of consciousness that most people don't operate at. That it's too much for most language centers to hold in one place. But I think it's in an increasingly complex world, it's necessary for more consciousnesses to be able to stretch themselves and allow a little bit more complexity in with issues like this.
If it's an increasingly complex world at all. Lately, it's been seeming to get more black and white again. More good guys, bad guys. I mean, that's the thing I'm struggling with, is I've gone from like fundamentalism to nuance And what I'm fighting now is going back to a fundamentalism in which the roles are reversed.
Yeah. It's chemically satisfying to have that justified hatred, you know?
Oh, the brain loves another. It loves another clear, these are with me, these are against me. That's as good as jogging. I mean, the brain loves it. Contemplating subtlety and nuance. You don't like to use those circuits. You know, they're slow. They don't make snap decisions. Your brain wants to be able to make decisions very quickly because what is civilization?
And it's also like everybody's in the middle of doing their ego's thing, trying to pay the bills, trying to get what they need to be done. And it's like, you know, if a soccer player, every time they got the ball, stopped for 30 seconds to consider why they chose that size of ball as the soccer league's choice, you know, like, you get the ball taken from you. We're talking with Shane about sometimes how it seems like Christians are actually more prone to accepting systemic forms of violence because in the narrative, in the meta-narrative in our minds, the ultimate reality, God, is what demanded blood for justice. That's sort of the way things are at the core. And so it's easier for a Christian to accept, yeah, well, somebody does something bad, you kill them. I guess we haven't talked about it on the podcast very much. Not a big fan of substitutionary atonement. If you follow me on Twitter, you might... I see
really?
That as well.
You're not?
Here's the big twist that I realized after one of my Twitter rants. From the reference frame of seeing God as something fundamentally separate from you or I find this the story of substitutionary atonement repugnant and horrible and disgusting. But that's not actually the way that I see God. So I was realizing, like, okay, stop defining the words based on what you assume they're defining the words as. And the way I see God, isness, oneness, the all, the none, the ground of being, but also the abstraction of being and non-being. It all becomes pretty literally true. So, in other words, God killed God, and this becomes a sacrifice within God's mind that allows God to make peace with God. I realized that my aversion to substitutionary atonement was basically an aversion to assuming a separation from God. Mm. Which, so in a way, like, the fundamentalists are correct in saying that I just can't accept the gospel because I don't want to acknowledge myself as a sinner in need of grace. So I had that thought and it made me laugh. But it's interesting to see, like, what I fight against is this sort of concept of a Zeus-like God that is separate from me and humanity, demanding blood of his son.
You should read James. Yeah, you're resisting the Hellenization of the faith. So did James. So did Peter to some extent.
Keep going. I'm intrigued.
Well, I mean, the whole thing was... Paul was the rah-rah Gentiles guy. He was the Roman citizen. He was the educated in Western philosophy guy. And so his writings bring in more influence from Platonic ideals and Greco-Roman cosmology. Paul, to some degree, was an early Greco-Roman influence on the Christian faith. And James, the brother of Jesus, who was probably illiterate, was a Christian who was a practicing Jew, like really respected among the Jewish leaders as an observant Jew, but also respected in the early church because of his faith in Christ. Many historians believe that James and Peter were kind of like the main figures in the early church for Jews in and around Jerusalem. You know, ancient Israel, modern day, the West Bank and Israel or Palestine. We do see some tension between those views happening in the respective texts that are attributed to those authors. You know, James likely was writing through a scribe or one of his followers, was trying to accurately represent James' point of view because he could actually read and write. But it's still, I've seen many historians, including secular historians, who believe that the book of James might be like the most credible snapshot of early Christianity that we have. And it does seem to resist some of these Hellenized ideas.
Well, but it makes me wonder how metaphysically Paul was attached to those ideas, because there's communication to a context that I actually think is good. I think without the gospel of Jesus being Hellenized, if it's just rooted to ancient Judaism, it becomes stagnant and limited in what it can be. So moving into other contexts and other cultures with their language and their imagery and their metaphors, I think is great. As long as you don't take those metaphors and imagery and everything and language too seriously, and can realize that it can also then take it and go to another culture and take root there. So, I mean, if I'm trying to speak the ultimate mysteries to Amelie, and I use fairies and princesses in my words, I don't think that's like a problem, unless you start taking fairies and princesses too seriously in what I'm saying, you know, like the literal idea of those things. So Paul saying to people that use sacrifices and conceive of gods needing blood and all these things, using some of that imagery to kind of subvert it from within and say, you don't need sacrifices anymore. Here's why. Here, it all solves itself. If he's not believing literally in those images as being sort of the actual pictures of reality, that there's really some being up in the sky that is doing these things, you know, it actually is kind of a beautiful judo move, I think. Mm. Going with the flow of the culture, using, that's what he did at Mars Hill with, look at this statue, here's what your poets are saying, in him we live and move and have our being, to the unknown God. Let me tell you about this guy. He's kind of going with the flow of the culture, with the language of the culture, with the discussion of the culture. So why wouldn't he have done that to people that think sacrifice is a legitimate need existentially? Why wouldn't he say the ultimate sacrifice has been paid? That's a positive view of Paul. It's optimistic. But I just thought it was funny that I could find a way of saying that I believe in substitutionary atonement.
I actually, you started laughing, and I didn't laugh because I was so with you. I was like, what's funny about that? I was just, yeah, absolutely. That's just, yeah, that would be exactly how I would interpret that.
Yeah. Which, it's funny that I approach some theological ideas through lenses that I don't actually subscribe to, arguing against a subset of that idea of this separate God in the sky, when I don't even believe in this. But then again, maybe there's still some part of me that does. Who knows? We had we got to have Peter Rollins on the podcast again, by the way. He came over the other night and we had good conversation. He was talking about how he was at some place and they were trying to nail him down with what he believes about God. Does God exist or not? And he's like, I have no idea what I believe. That's my entire work, is that you don't either. You have no idea what you believe. He did this whole thing with like this room of atheists. And I think he borrowed some of it from Darren Brown, the magician. But he basically said, everybody pull up a picture of someone you really love on your phone. And they did like a loved one. And then he pulled out this piece of paper and he said, here is an ancient curse that people used to use. It's like a written out satanic curse. And he's like, could somebody come up here and read this curse over the person on your phone? And nobody would. Not one person. He's like, see, you all say you don't believe this. Why won't somebody? Come on, you. And he pointed out like this really militant atheist guy. He's like, no, I'm not doing that. He's like, why? It doesn't mean anything. And he just wouldn't do it. So he's like, you don't know what you believe. There's part of you that resists that for a reason. You have all these weird beliefs underneath and superstitions underneath all of it that you don't know. So you ask me what I believe. I have no idea what I believe.
Preach. I'll amen to that.
That's amazing.
Absolutely. What do I believe? Depends on the moment. Depends on what part of my brain is exerting the most control over my conscious experience at that exact point in time.
Yeah. That's interesting in terms of violence. And violence, like, what do I believe about violence? You don't know. You don't know what you would do if somebody came into your house. You don't know how you would respond. Mm. That's not something you can know that you believe, because it's in your language constructs of, I subscribe to this philosophy of nonviolence, except for when A and B and C are crossed, and then you can move into just war. No, there's just something in the guts and in the heart and in the being of a person that when you move far enough into love and into nonviolence as a way of life and a way of being, that you can eventually look at the person that's nailing you into the cross and say, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And that's not a belief. That's love.
We hope this episode has been enlightening and helpful. If you'd like to see additional resources, or if you'd like to join in a conversation about this episode with other listeners, visit theliturgist.com/podcast. You can connect with us on Twitter at @theliturgist or on Facebook at facebook.com/theliturgist. We'd like to thank Greg Nordine, Corey Pigg, and Madison Chandler for their contributions in helping produce this episode.
The music on today's episode was from On Earth, which is a collaboration between Tyler Chester and I. You can find our first volume of music that you'll hear on this podcast out on all the places you've listened to music. There's also music from Gunger and Paper Chaser, which is Tyler's moniker for some of his personal music. Thanks again to Shane Claiborne for being part of this episode, and a special thanks to all the patrons who make the work that we do possible.
Michael Gunger and I, Science Mike, have been your hosts. Thanks for listening, everyone.